From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The head coach of the NFL's only undefeated team has a special affinity for numbers. Ahead on Only a Game, counting upwards in Kansas City with Dick Vermeil. Also, Pat Forte checks in with his annual men's college basketball preview and forechecking with rink rats for whom hockey is no longer a foregone conclusion. Also ahead on Only a Game, elders pass the love of long-distance running down to young people on Arizona's Hopi Reservation.
It's in our blood, and it's always going to be there as long as they're running and as long as they're going to keep their roots deep here. We're always going to have a good cross-country team.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. At least 15 people were killed today in two explosions at synagogues in downtown Istanbul. At least 100 people were injured. The Turkish Interior Minister said the almost simultaneous blasts were the work of suicide bombers. The BBC's Stephen Bryant reports.
Prayers were being said at the synagogue in Şişli when one blast went off. Around 3 kilometers south, a second blast rocked the street outside the Neve Shalom Synagogue, the city's main Jewish place of worship and the site of a lethal gun attack in 1986. Outside the Neve Shalom Synagogue, windows had been blasted out for meters up and down the street. Men with bleeding faces walked in a daze, and eyewitnesses reported seeing body parts strewn across the road. The main Turkish news agency said it had received a claim of responsibility from a radical Islamic group, but police said they were still investigating other possible links to radicals, including the possibility of Al-Qaeda.
The BBC's Stephen Bryant in Istanbul. There was another bombing in Baghdad today. A U.S. soldier was killed. Paul Bremer, the top American official in Iraq, met today with members of the Iraqi Governing Council to discuss the potential handover of sovereignty to an interim Iraqi leadership by the middle of next year. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Baghdad.
Iraqi officials said they were encouraged by Bremer's new willingness to speed the transfer of authority to Iraqis, even before a new constitution is drafted. Details remain to be worked out, but some officials suggested there would be a series of regional meetings to select delegates who would decide on a transitional government. That body would then oversee the constitutional process and national elections. Leaders of Shiite Muslims, who make up the majority in Iraq, had insisted that constitutional drafters be elected, setting up a deadlock with Sunni and Kurdish representatives. This compromise was seen by Washington as a way to break the impasse. The talks came as one U.S. soldier was killed and two more wounded in a roadside bomb attack in Baghdad. In the northern city of Mosul, an Iraqi translator for the municipality and his son were shot and killed by gunmen. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Baghdad.
The BBC is reporting that security services in Britain have been placed on a higher level of alert, that there are intelligence reports that Al-Qaeda may be planning a new attack. The BBC report said the change was not connected to next week's trip to Britain by President Bush. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is in Japan, where he met with defense officials and with U.S. troops serving there. A major topic between the two governments is legal protections for U.S. troops charged with crimes in Japan. The U.S. wants the accused to have access to a lawyer before indictment. Japanese officials say this goes beyond protections given their own citizens. You're listening to NPR News. Chicago Teachers Union delegates voted narrowly yesterday to approve a tentative contract agreement. Rank-and-file teachers will vote Tuesday on whether to accept the deal or walk off the job December 4th. From Chicago Public Radio, Jay Field reports.
The close vote is a sign in part of the political jockeying and divisions roiling the union as it seeks to finalize a new contract. Union leaders blame the narrow margin of victory on a letter circulated by opponents alleging that a provision of the contract could put the pension fund for city teachers at risk. The union denies the charge and says the agreement improves on an earlier deal rejected by teachers several weeks ago. This latest pact shortens the overall length of the contract from 5 to 4 years, adds 15 extra minutes to the school day instead of 20, and pares down an increase in health insurance costs. Teachers vote on the offer Tuesday. If they reject it, Chicago could face its first teacher strike in 16 years. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field in Chicago.
A nurses' strike in Michigan is now in its second year. Nurses walked off the job last November at Northern Michigan Hospital. Since then, there have been no negotiations and none are planned. The two sides don't even agree on what's in dispute. The hospital says the strike is about money and a union power grab. The nurses say it's about working conditions and quality of care. Salvage teams in southern China are searching for the cause of yesterday's explosion at a government-owned coal mine. Officials now say 49 miners were killed. China's coal mines are among the deadliest in the world. More than 4,200 deaths have been reported so far this year. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The entire sports world was shocked this week when Miles Brand, the president of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, said that many universities were running their basketball programs like professional franchises, placing too much emphasis on winning and trying to make money and paying insufficient attention to academics. Among the most astonished to hear this charge, I'm sure, was Pat Forty, who writes about college basketball for the Louisville Courier-Journal and for ESPN.com. He's also Only a Game's college basketball guy. He joins me now from Louisville. Hi, Pat.
Hello, Bill. How you doing?
I'm well, but were you shocked by President Brand's contention, or were you just shocked to learn that he'd been on another planet for about 50 years?
Oh, I was shocked and more shocked, absolutely. You know, it's, you know me, I'd pretty much thought that we were still back in the 1950s. Oh, wait, there was point shaving in the
50s. Oh, yeah, too. Oops, CCNY.
let's try the 30s. Yeah, I'm not sure where President Brand has been. I mean, college basketball has had more comportment and, I guess, citizenship issues than any other sport that I can think of in terms of college athletics. So this was not exactly breaking news to me.
Your alma mater, the University of Missouri, has been picked this time around to reach the Final Four, but oops, some of those extracurricular activities may come into play then. Maybe they don't get to the tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. This could be the best season in school history if it's allowed to continue into the postseason. Missouri has never been to a Final Four before, and this team definitely has the talent to do so, but the questions out there are awfully serious, and the answers that I've heard, at least, are not very convincing when you've got the head coach saying, yes, mistakes were made, and, you know, there's a lot of serious allegations out there, payments, academic flim-flammery, and the like. And, yeah, I think there's a pretty good chance that Missouri could be one of the best teams ever to be banned from the postseason before the postseason gets here, and that would be a darn shame for the rest of the team, but if they did it, lock them up.
The Connecticut Huskies are the number one team in virtually every preseason poll. Do they deserve that sort of ranking?
For both genders, yes,
absolutely.
I think so. Yeah, I think that Connecticut is head and shoulders right now, at least in terms of on paper. The funny thing is, Bill, you know, it never really turns out that way. The last, I believe, seven national champions were certainly not the team that started the season as the consensus favorite. The last team that I could figure out that began the year number one and wound up ending the year number one was Kentucky in 1995-96, and they had so much future NBA talent on there, I'm not sure they could have missed. So there's been a lot of teams that looked really good in November but couldn't quite close the deal in April. We'll have to see about Connecticut, but I'd put them up there right now.
All right, so maybe the Connecticut men's team being ranked number one is magnificent news for number two, Duke.
Could well be. That's, you know, yeah, the second tier, Duke, Michigan State, Missouri, should they get the leg irons off in time. And I think Arizona probably is up there too. But, yeah, that could well be the case.
It is very hard to play basketball in leg irons, above all sports.
It's going to hurt your vertical and your quickness.
Syracuse, the defending national champion, lost heralded freshman Carmelo Anthony to the NBA after Syracuse had finally won a title. The Orange men have any chance to repeat?
Is that where Carmelo went? I thought it was med school.
No, well, it was very brief. You had to look quickly to see him.
Yeah, I think they have a very – they should have a very good team again this year. We got to see a little bit of some of the surrounding parts to Carmelo last year about how good they were in Jerry McNamara and Hakeem Warwick and Billy Edlin. And, you know, they play that problematic zone defense. I think they're going to be one of those teams that is going to be, you know, probably in the top 10 and right there going to have a chance at it.
We've brought up Carmelo Anthony. Should we be looking around for other freshmen elsewhere who can lead their teams to glory?
I don't think there's probably somebody out there that's quite capable of doing what he did, although there are going to be some, as usual, some very good freshmen in there. And Duke has one of the guys who I think has a chance to step in and be a star right away, and Luol Deng, who's going to probably be a starting forward for them. And he has enough other talent around him. He's not going to have you know, 20-point, 10-rebound season like Carmelo Anthony did to lead them to a title. He just has to step in and be good. So that's a team with a freshman. Connecticut has another very good freshman in Charlie Villanueva. Wake Forest has a McDonald's All-American, probably start at point guard in Chris Paul, and they should be kind of one of those underrated, sneaky teams. So there will definitely be a number of freshmen who will make their presence felt, because as the game it gets younger and younger and upperclassmen are less evidence, there's going to be more of those guys.
One of my favorite results in the early going has the Harlem Globetrotters going 7-0 against various college teams so far, including Syracuse and Michigan State. If the college game is becoming more like the pros anyway, as Mr. Brand has said is the case, why not put the Globies in the Big East? There are vacancies, right?
Absolutely, yes. There's talk again about Notre Dame jumping conference to the ACC, and so there might be a spot for him. Give the Globies a shot. Where's Marcus Haynes? Get the red, white, and blue ball and the striped shorts out there. Put sweet Georgia Brown on the loudspeakers, and let's go.
Get the bucket with the confetti in it where everybody thinks they're going to get wet and all that.
Sure. Yeah. You know what? The coaches take themselves all too seriously. It would be great for them to all get a dose of the Globetrotters.
Pat, it's somewhere between difficult and impossible to foresee who will win before the season starts, of course, but that hasn't stopped ESPN.com from posting hypothetical brackets for the NCAA tournament in March. While we're at it, why doesn't ESPN.com just fill out the brackets for the next 10 years and then we don't have to waste all that money actually playing the games?
It's a great point. You know, you can never start too early. You know, we might as well go ahead and fill the starting gates for the Kentucky Derby, and
there
they can tell us who's going to win the Masters and Wimbledon and everything else as well. But that's insane. But college basketball fans are generally unhealthy and mentally, and so this is the kind of thing that I, you know what, I know this, living here in Louisville, one of the hotbeds of basketball insanity, I saw a number of fan message boards where this was big discussion. I can't believe they have Kentucky a number 4 seed. I can't believe Louisville's only a number 7 seed. You know, it's like, it's November. Hello.
Hey, even if it were, oh, I don't know, April.
Yeah, right. Take a deep breath. Enjoy the games.
Pat Forde covers college basketball for the Louisville Courier-Journal and for ESPN.com, and he is, of course, our regular college basketball analyst. Pat, thank you again.
My pleasure, Bill.
The Kansas City Chiefs are the only unbeaten NFL squad this season. Manning the chalkboard of the team boasting a 9-0 record is a mellow fellow with a mathematical bent who wasn't always that way. Greg Eklund has this report.
Playoff teams win on the road, not like they do at home. Average playoff team at home wins 6 games, loses 2. On the road, they win 5, lose 3.
Kansas City Chiefs head coach Dick Vermeil tosses numbers around as frequently as a college math professor.
Plus 2 last year. For the entire season, if you were an average team, you won 83% of your games. If you were a playoff team, you had 30 wins and 1 loss, being plus 2. You better win when you're plus 2.
Don't feel bad if you didn't understand any of that. Even for Chiefs starting quarterback Trent Green, who has played for Vermeil in St. Louis and Kansas City, numbers like those can be hard to get used to.
He's got every stat that you could possibly think of, not only about teams and rushing yards and attempts and time of possession and turnover ratio, but he's got quarterback ratings from playoff caliber teams. Since you name it, he's got the stat for it.
Before last Sunday's game between the Chiefs and the Cleveland Browns, the sound of sizzling grills could only be barely heard over talk of the Chiefs' sizzling 9-0 start, the best in franchise history.
I've already got goosebumps, and we're still 30 minutes away from the game.
What about this team in particular?
They say 16-0. I just hope they lose one before then, because I don't want to go to the playoffs and lose.
The Chiefs' near misses of the 90s are hard for fans to forget. The team fell one game short of the Super Bowl after the 94 season. The following year, they lost in the playoffs to the Indianapolis Colts, despite having home field advantage. It's not as bad as the Cubs' World Series drought, but the 1970s Super Bowl is becoming a distant memory for the Chiefs. Team president Carl Peterson hoped to change that when he hired Vermeil, with whom he worked while at UCLA and with the Philadelphia Eagles.
He's been successful because he's Dick Vermeil, and he's been successful at every level, high school, junior college, college, major college, and obviously the NFL. And because he is a wine connoisseur, he's gotten better with age.
As Peterson suggests, Vermeil was much more tightly wound in Philadelphia and St. Louis, but now it's not unusual for Vermeil to have players over to his house for dinner and a fine vintage. Vermeil's new approach is almost fatherly, and often he refers to the members of his team as the kids. Chiefs place kicker Morton Anderson, a 22-year NFL veteran who's played for seven different head coaches, says Vermeil's personal style sets him apart from other coaches.
He's able to relate to guys from different backgrounds, from all walks of life, which is what we have here in a locker room like this. And he's able to communicate, I think, very effectively what he wants to get done, business-wise.
And the Chiefs head coach has made it his business to win. Until Vermeil accomplished it this year, no coach in the NFL had ever directed three different teams to starts of 6-0 or better. But though Vermeil is a stat freak, he scoffs when it's pointed out that the last three NFL teams to start 9-0 have won the Super Bowl.
No, that means crap. The only thing it means is we're 9-0. I'll tell you this. Since 1990, there have been 13 teams be 6-0 and better. And eight of them were beaten by a team without a winning record. Someone's going to beat us. It's going to be a real good football team.
The Chiefs will try to make it 10-0 tomorrow in Cincinnati against the 4-5 Bengals. Regardless of what happens tomorrow, Chiefs fans hope the numbers add up to an appearance at Reliance Stadium in Houston for Super Bowl 38.
And the head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs, Dick Vermeil.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. The fastest, or at least the most elusive runner at England's Sheffield horse racing course recently has been a collie that's earned the nickname Dwayne after the European champion sprinter Dwayne Chambers. The four-legged Dwayne, most likely an abandoned pet, has been firing around the track and environs for several months, and racing officials are beginning to get impatient. The ante was up to this week when a bookmaking firm offered £500 of free bets to anyone who could capture Dwayne, but the local dog warden, Shane Roxby, has been trying to do that for some time without success. "If he sees me, he puts his head down and he runs," said Roxby, "just like an ostrich, he's off." Just like an ostrich?
I'm Steve Brown with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Tampa Bay Lightning lit up the Washington Capitals for 5 goals and allowed only 2. The Boston Bruins blanked the Blue Jackets of Columbus. The score was 4-0 in that contest. There were 3 overtime games last night in which the Pittsburgh Penguins edged the Dallas Stars 2-0, the Detroit Red Wings downed the Chicago Blackhawks 4-3, and the Phoenix Coyotes and the Dallas Stars skated to a 3-3 tie. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston. We'll be right back.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a red-tailed hawk sends an Iron Man a message. But first, for every adult who wishes he or she could sweep check like Scott Stevens, muck it up like Frank Mahovlich, or roof the biscuit with a flair of Jean Ratel, there is hope. Each fall in Lake Placid, New York, slightly long of tooth hockey students convene to learn the finer points of the world's coolest game from teachers with NHL experience. This year, 54 mostly middle-aged campers from the U.S. and Canada attended. Reporter John Kalish was there.
On the opening night of hockey camp, everyone goes to dinner at a local Italian restaurant named Mr. Mike's. It's a spirited affair in which doctors and building contractors share tables and pitchers of beer. Everyone has to stand up and introduce themselves, starting with Paul Crowley, the founder of Canadian Hockey Enterprises, which runs the hockey camp.
I'm Paul Crowley.
Stand up, Crow.
I am standing up.
I'm John Pelicone. I'm the goaltender for the Red Team. I'm a pulmonary critical care physician from Rockland County, New York.
I'm Evelyn Isbell. I'm from Richest, New York. I got involved through my father. He played semi-professional hockey for the New York Rangers back in the 50s. And I'm here to basically learn how to be a better forward.
Mike Valancourt, Westbrook, Maine. If you see me wandering aimlessly about on a wing, it's because I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing.
My name's John Cargan. I'm a trooper with the Pennsylvania State Police. It's my first camp, and I had some unfortunate injuries, parachute accident, a helicopter accident. I try and stay on the ground now.
Some of these campers are return customers, including some who've been coming for 15 years. This is Bob Werber's 9th year at hockey camp. He grew up on Long Island and played pond hockey as a kid. Werber returned to the sport when he was in his 30s. He's now 49 and says he loves being able to think about nothing but hockey for 4 days.
I think I'm probably getting worse all the time at this stage of the game. I'm like a good high school level player. I do pick up skills here, but I'd say I come more for the experience. It's just a kind of 100% hockey thing. You feel like you're really stepping out of your life.
For 4 days, the life here in Lake Placid consists of drills, scrimmages, and watching videos of yourself drilling and scrimmaging. It all takes place on the hallowed ice of Lake Placid's Olympic Center, where an underdog United States ice hockey team defeated the Soviet Union and went on to win the 1980 gold medal. Coach Brent Tully works with two players at a time, using a video playback system set up in the penalty box.
The biggest thing that I noticed when we were doing the wrist shot was that most of the people were using their arms right, but the reason why they weren't generating enough power was the fact that, again, they weren't shifting their weight enough, using their whole body, you know what I mean? It was like a... Whereas if we use that weight, shift that weight, see how that came mainly from your arms?
Uh-huh.
The coaching staff includes Gilles Gilbert, an NHL goalie from 1969 to 1983, Al McDonough, an NHL All-Star who played with the Pittsburgh Penguins, and Glenn Murkowski, who played for the New Jersey Devils and is now a scout for the Detroit Red Wings.
Okay, now if I'm standing in front of the goaltender this way, and I'm screening him, what I want to do is just redirect this way, bring the puck back towards the net this way, or bring it out this way and bring the puck back towards the net this way.
You move towards the shooter just a little bit. He's winding up.
Yeah, you can.
Murkowski says he's impressed by the increasing number of older people participating in organized hockey, including 40-somethings with no previous experience.
When you pick it up later on in life, you don't know all the fundamentals. So when we go over the fundamentals of backwards skating, for example, like we did today, you know, we go up and down the ice 3 or 4 times, and because you've introduced a new fundamental and some new ideas to them, you actually see their skating improve in about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. It's actually amazing, and they're out there and they're paying attention because, you know what, they came here to learn some of those things. They're not here because they have to be. They're here because they want to be.
8 women attended this year's adult hockey camp, the most females ever to suit up. They play on the same teams as the men. 46-year-old Jennifer Lasky started playing when she signed up her 2 sons for hockey in Canada, thinking it would inspire her boys if she learned the sport with them.
I just got completely addicted. There was no hockey offered when I was a kid, and I love it. My boys have all dropped out, and I continue. I play summer and winter.
When you play back home, you're playing against 20-year-olds.
Yeah, yeah, and they're fast, and age does creep up on one. But it's good. It keeps me spry.
And what do your boys think?
Oh, they laugh. They think this is really funny. My husband stays home and sews, and mom goes out to play hockey. So it's a very mishmashed house.
Let's play hockey!
On the last day of hockey camp, the four teams play each other in a basically empty arena.
Ah! Easy, Ralphie.
After the game, most valuable players are named for each team, and one by one, the hockey campers are called up and given medals.
Eric B. Martin.
The participants get to keep their jerseys and videos of their time in hockey camp. Scott Weiner, a 50-year-old lawyer from New York City, says he's returning home a better hockey player.
I've generally been fairly dreadful, and I'm getting a little better.
In what way?
Well, the slap shot is technically better. I developed a snap shot, which I never was able to do, and the wrist shot's better, too.
Weiner and others at adult hockey camp say that they play whenever ice time is available, as early as 6 a.m. and as late as midnight. But despite the odd hours and the various aches and pains of middle age, these campers just keep skating. 43-year-old Gary Turner works for a cable TV company in Springfield, Massachusetts.
My lawyer just quit. He was 76. He was playing four times a week, and his knees gave out, so I guess that's what I'm shooting for. I'm out there playing now with two discs bulging in my back, and unless they cut my legs off, I think I'll be playing.
Canadian Hockey Enterprises will hold its next adult hockey camp in October 2004. A parent and child hockey camp will be held in Lake Placid in April. The company runs adult hockey tournaments in Nevada, Florida, New York, and Canada. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in Lake Placid, New York.
Stories of professional athletes who've had difficulties adjusting to life after the games are over are myriad. Maybe those stories are part of what led Scott Tinley to write Racing the Sunset, an athlete's quest for life after sport. Certainly a larger part of Tinley's motivation was his own struggle to make meaning of his days when he could no longer compete with the best triathletes in the world. Scott Tinley joins me now from the studios of KPBS in San Diego. Scott, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to be here.
One characteristic that seems common to a lot of the athletes that you cite, yourself included, is something most folks would regard as narcissism. Is that a fair charge against top pro athletes, guys who and women who really identify themselves by their profession that way?
Well, you know, I hate to say that it's a charge. It's more a necessary reality of the chosen profession.
Hmm.
Especially in sports that take extreme amount of hours and commitment and dedication. In endurance sports in particular, the world has to revolve around you. You know, and you have to sort of identify what you have to eat at a certain period and when you can take your rest and the equipment and the travel and your training and its hours. My commitment at my peak was probably 50 to 60 hours a week. In hindsight, it was all me, and my wife, bless her heart, was very sort of understanding of that because it was my profession. But in hindsight, I think, boy, you know, that was narcissistic, yet it allowed me to achieve what I did. It's difficult to achieve a balance in life and be the best at everything. So you're going to have to give something up. You become a compromise, and you won't be the best at anything.
Perhaps the most dramatic passage in your book describes the moment when you knew that your career as a competitive athlete was coming to an end. Tell us about that moment.
Well, I think the irony is that every professional athlete can look back at one specific moment in time, usually revolving around an event when they had this sort of cold, harsh reality that they're never going to be as good as they once were, and they were going to have to face the rest of their life. And for me, that was during an event in 91 where I stopped in the middle of a race just to watch this beautiful red-tailed hawk sort of float around the trees. The finish line was only a mile away, and there I was sort of watching a bird.
Is it something that could have happened? If it had happened 5 years earlier to you, would you have even noticed the hawk? Or was this just kind of a serendipitous coming together of time and place and symbol? Or tell me about that.
Well, if it would have happened 5 years earlier, I wouldn't have noticed it. Or if I had noticed it, I wouldn't have processed it the way that I did. So, yes, it was serendipitous and kismetic and any other word that you could come up with that just has to do with, you know, happenstance and where things all come together in some harmonic convergence. But I am appreciative of the fact that I did stop. And looking back, I think I was, you know, running in third or fourth place, and there was prize money available, and there I was watching people pass me. But it was just one of those things that I had to do, and I had no choice over my actions and my feelings, because it was that turning point of my worlds where I knew that I had to shift from one to the other, and there was no choice.
What do you suppose the people running by you were thinking? Hey, what's the matter with Tinley? He must have a cramp or something.
Well, more than likely, and that's the other thing, you know. People even now, they look at what I'm doing, and you know, I was so athletic and so physical, and they look at me now and they go, geez, you're a geek, all you do is read and write. And you hang out at school and in the library. I can't stand being around you. You're no fun. People want to remember professional athletes while they're at their peak, because to watch them decline is to admit their own mortality.
And there are other kind of less horrific admissions. You notice at one point, after you stop training quite so much, that your hair is darker. It's not so bleached by the sun anymore. Too much time in the library.
Exactly true. But there are those pug marks that identify you, and people look at you and they, you know, they don't want to allow you to change. And so ultimately, the lesson that I think that can be pulled out of this for everybody is that we all go through loss. We all go through transition and change. And it's one of the truest things that we could not avoid. The American public doesn't understand what happens to the athletes. You know, they're somewhat curious about them. They look at boxers, you know, trying to make an extra buck toward the end, and they hear the anecdotes about the tragedy and the person who lost his fortune. But there's a lot of pathos that goes on, and I think there should be a lot more exposure of the subject and a lot more empathy for the athlete, not just the adulation while he's playing, but the fact that we use them and we use them up, and we should treat them more as humans as opposed to just subjects.
You were among the top triathletes in the world for 20 years, more than 20 years, really. The stopwatch proved it. But for a writer, there's no infallible measuring instrument. Some readers will think your book is great. Some will regard it as junk. Do you miss the certain knowledge, easily measurable, that you've won or at least finished in the top 10?
Absolutely. It is that immediacy of gratification, or at least recognition of your performance, that is so tangible and so desirable in sport. In other areas, whether it's academics or business, it often, you know, is that deferment of finding out whether or not you were successful. So I guess what I've tried to do is take the stance that the only thing I can do is become the best writer that I can, and to be the most honest and thoughtful and research the subjects. And if I'm writing fiction, to do the best job I can based upon my own skills, and put it out there. And if people enjoy it, then, and they accept it, then that's great. And if they don't, well, at least, you know, I've gained something intrinsic and valuable to me during the process and the journey.
Scott Tinley, former Ironman triathlon champion, is the author of Racing the Sunset, published by the Lions Press. Scott, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Yes, well, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game. In last week's program, reporter Nahani Rouse told the story of racist language and behavior in the stands at soccer games in Israel. David B. Hershenson, a WBUR listener, responded, quote, I find it appalling that even a pathetic Saturday morning time filler like Only a Game engages in keeping up the drumbeat of Israel bashing. How about presenting a segment on Israelis playing on Arab nation soccer teams? What? There are none? No racism there, is there? You should retitle your program Only a Shame. Of the same story, Linda Mitchell, who hears the program on WBFO in Buffalo, wrote, quote, although I agree that integrating the professional teams themselves will help to foster individual relationships between Jewish Israeli and Arab Israeli players, I doubt that this will do much to foster change where it is really necessary among the fans of the teams. Until the Israeli government ceases to promote anti-Arab racism and the Arab states cease to demonize the state of Israel, the mass psychosis will never end. Brian Aviles of Sandwich, Massachusetts, thought last week's story by Kim Green about lawnmower racing was, quote, a cut above your normal standard of excellence. Steve Engler, another WBUR listener, wrote to say he appreciates, quote, the eclectic nature of your show and to ask for, quote, more and more of this type of sports story. Oh, please. From Granite City, Illinois, Greg Kessler emailed to say, I hate sports. You could not get me to watch anything besides pro wrestling without holding a gun to my head, but I love sports history and sports business, and I love Only a Game. Finally, on Sunday, Art Carney, best known for his portrayal of Ed Norton on The Honeymooners, passed away at the age of 85. Shortly thereafter, Ricardo Quiñones emailed as follows, I hope you can find time to eulogize Mr. Carney, however briefly, as he delivered the punchline to the best sports joke ever written. Mr. Quiñones, I hope you're listening.
The golf swing. First, step up. Plant your feet firmly on the ground and address the ball. Hello, ball.
Send us your candidate for best sports joke ever. Your letter will reach us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can contact us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our official email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Waveland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, rally, fellas.
The Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. Goal! The Bulls win!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports and maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Steve Brown with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA action, the Boston Celtics outparried the Cleveland Cavaliers 91-82. The Miami Heat beat the Washington Wizards 105-101 in overtime. Philadelphia stopped San Antonio 100-96. Phoenix foiled Houston 90-85. Denver downed Orlando 106-101. And the Los Angeles Clippers staved off playoff elimination by virtue of their 104-98 win over Golden State. Elsewhere, New Jersey Knicks New York 85-80, Indiana stunned Seattle 101-78, Utah topped Minnesota 85-77. Sacramento drubbed Toronto 94-64. And the Lakers put away the Pistons 94-89. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, two sports dynasties flourish in the desert, one for the boys and one for the girls. But first, our look at the sports news of the week with analyst Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and a hearty hello, Mon, to our new listeners at WVGN in St. Thomas. And may I just say, we wish we were there.
Results from Major League Baseball steroid tests are in, and they indicate that, yes, more than 5% of all major leaguers are taking steroids. According to last year's labor contract, that means players will be subject to suspensions and fines beginning next year. Does this signal the end of steroid use? And I'm sorry, I can't help smiling a little when I ask.
I don't know. I mean, my attitude towards this whole issue has always been science marches on. I mean, you're seeing with the THG wrangle now that if you design better tests, people will design better steroids.
Seems to
And frankly, that Major League Baseball is saying that between 5 and 7% of major leaguers tested positive seems low to me, given the kind of over-the-top frenzy we were fed for the better part of a couple of years.
On Thursday, track star Marion Jones and Kansas City Chiefs wide receiver Johnny Morton, among others, testified in the ongoing Balco investigation. Before that round of testimony, Raiders running back Tyrone Wheatley allegedly went after a photographer. Roid rage?
Yeah, he raised his right fist and slapped a photographer when the guy tried to shoot his picture. I mean, not dissimilar to hundreds of other things that happen outside courthouses in America every day. I would like to find out, though, and I haven't, and all stories on this are unclear, as to whether this grand jury is investigating Balco because they ducked their taxes or is investigating Balco because they created this drug that was neither illegal nor against the rules of any sport, in which case the scandal eludes me.
On Wednesday, it was revealed that four American track and field athletes tested positive for the aforementioned THG, the so-called designer steroid, which is, of course, at the center of the Balco investigation. But International Olympic Committee President Jacques Roga said Tuesday that abusive THG is, quote, probably not a worldwide issue. So I guess he's saying Americans are ahead of the curve on this one.
Well, I mean, I suspect Jacques Roga should get in touch with a part of his gut that has slightly better judgment. Of course, if this is an issue, it is a worldwide issue. Everybody knows everybody else. Everybody talks to everybody else. Word gets around.
I must once again hand it to El Predicto. Charlie, this time your prediction about Michelle Wee was dead on. The 14-year-old golfer has accepted a sponsor's exemption, and she will play in the PGA Tour's Sony Open in January.
This is Annika Sorenstam multiplied by the Mickey Mouse Club. This is a tremendous... You know, even a greater public relations boon than Annika Sorenstam was, because Michelle Wee is only 14 years old.
There you go.
So not only do you get the women playing in the men's tournament angle, you get the pixie angle.
Which the has children
been
playing
tremendous,
in the PGA.
You know, which has been a tremendous boon to things like figure skating and gymnastics.
One of the big NFL stories this week, at least if you judge by newspaper and talk show coverage, is Bill Parcells versus Bill Belichick. Why is coach versus coach such a big deal leading up to Sunday night's Cowboys-Patriots game?
Well, because their relationship has been so complex and wonderful down through the years. It can now be stated as historical fact that Bill Belichick has won a Super Bowl without Bill Parcells, but that Bill Parcells has never won a Super Bowl without Bill Belichick. Neither man would want that formulated that way, even though it's the truth. It's always interesting to watch a protege step out of the shadow, which Belichick, of course, did in a big way, winning the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. And now Bill Parcells has gone down there and worked magic with a football team that, frankly, isn't very good.
Or certainly weren't very good last year.
I mean, their offense is rudimentary at best. He's managed to put together a defense which is not necessarily big, but very fast and very smart. And once again, he's shown the incredible gift he has for dealing with troubled athletes. Terry Glenn, who's sort of the Lawrence Taylor of wide receivers, is playing for him again.
Here's a development which may further underscore the absurdity of the title World Series. Did you ever think you'd see the day, and are you ready for a soccer-style baseball World Cup?
Well, I mean, I think you eventually would run out of nations, and it's very odd that this thing is resurfacing again just as the United States has been eliminated from Olympic competition.
Oops, that was going to be my follow-up question. I wonder how much it has to do with the fact that the U.S. ain't going to the Olympic baseball tournament.
Well,
I think
the fact that this thing has been, they put the electrodes back on this thing's neck and turned up the voltage again has a lot to do with that. It would be an interesting, depending on where they played. I mean, if they were to play at different scenes in the Caribbean or perhaps in Asia, it would be a tremendous event. In the United States, it'd be another baseball tournament.
The failure of the U.S. team to make the Olympics in Athens, by the way, was significant, it seems to me, for two reasons. It may mean Roger Clemens won't pitch anymore, and it gave Tommy Lasorda one more reason to be loudly upset. Have I missed anything
here? He's very, very upset. The minor league drones among my friends are upset because apparently some of the more promising players didn't play enough in the tournament. But the fact is that no matter at what level you play, Little League, American Legion ball, Major Leagues, or Olympic baseball, good pitching beats good hitting, and that's what happened in the United States.
The ball, which Chicago Cubs fans wish Moises Alou had been able to catch, will be up for auction on December 1st, and I gather that it's not expected to bring top dollar.
Idiots of America, arise. You have nothing to lose but your money. Now, I mean, it is a foul ball.
Absolutely.
That went in the stands.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you could auction off the guy, I think if you could auction off like Steve Bartman,
no,
you'd get
don't
a
do
lot
that
of money.
Anymore.
I know there's 14th Amendment problems with this plan, but I think you'd probably get more money than you would for the ball.
In the nice guys do sometimes finish first, at least when the baseball writers are voting department, Tony Pena of the Kansas City Royals was named American League Manager of the Year. You got any problem with that result?
Not really. I mean, his team did what it was supposed to do in the second half of the season, which was be bad. But he did make a considerable amount of chicken salad out of that, which you're not supposed to be able to make chicken salad out of. 3, 4, and 5 were interesting to me. Ron Gardenhire of the Minnesota Twins, whose team completely fell apart. Ken Maka of Oakland, whose team blew a 2-0 lead to the Red Sox in the divisional series in the American League. And fourth, your pal and mine, Grady Little, who doesn't even have a job anymore.
It's not unprecedented, but yes, you're right.
This is one of these moments where Joe Torre must sit in his house in Florida and bang his head off the coffee table.
In the lawsuit that I've been expecting for a couple of decades, former heavyweight Chuck Wepner, possibly the real Rocky, finally got around to demanding money from Sylvester Stallone. Does the Bayonne Bleeder have a case?
Well, I think he was hanging on to see if Rocky's 9 through 11 made a bigger killing than the first couple. I mean, I guess he does. I mean, I'm not lawyer enough to know if the statute of limitations for trivial yet fascinating civil lawsuits has passed on this one. But it seems fairly clear that Sylvester Stallone modeled a great deal of the Rocky character on Chuck Wepner.
And not only modeled the character on Wepner, but advertised it that way.
That's right.
Went on and on and on doing so.
Inspired
that's
by it. That's right.
Finally, Charlie, we're on a roll regarding various attempts to set records. Last week, we acknowledged the record for most screws driven into a board in 6 seconds or something like that. This week, saw another brave attempt to achieve immortality.
Yeah, screws into a board and now a whole bunch of screws loose in Oregon. Students gathered at Oregon State University in Corvallis to break the record for the world's largest pillow fight.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, the old record was 645 people, which was set in Anderson County, Kansas, which means that's sort of a better place for a pillow fight. It's Anderson County, Kansas. Sounds like a place where they would have a pillow fight like every year.
If not every night. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and the Fur and Feathers Fly each week as we discuss sports of a sort. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Last weekend, the Hopi boys cross-country team won its 14th consecutive Arizona High School State Championship, and the Hopi girls won their 12th title in the past 14 years. Those are certainly impressive achievements, but to say that there's a high school sports dynasty being created amid the mesas of the Hopi Reservation in remote northeast Arizona would cast doubt on the definition of the word dynasty. That's because, as Daniel Crocker of Arizona Public Radio reports, athletic success at Hopi High School is just a small part of a running tradition that stretches for hundreds of years and thousands of miles.
Oh, the other man!
The Hopi High boys' cross-country team stretches in a narrow school hallway outside Coach Rick Baker's office. It's only 3 days before the state meet, but the boys are relaxed as Baker gives instructions for practice.
Okay, hey, we're going on middle tree line. Okay, hit the middle tree line, the one that we run for tempo run. Okay, be careful on that barbed wire over there.
Baker was a state champion miler in the late 70s. For the past 16 years, he's coached at Hopi High in the tiny town of Keams Canyon. Baker says the Hopi Reservation is the perfect training ground for runners.
You know, we're at almost close to 6,500 elevation, which is good for the body, you know, for the lungs. And then here at the high school, there's trails that we run. There's hills, there's flat, there's, you know, inclines and sandy hills and all that. So it's the perfect area for running training.
Today, the boys take part in what Baker calls a maintenance run. They take off in the crisp November air on a sandy trail that climbs toward a steep, rocky mesa. A full moon rises in the autumn sky in front of them. Junior Stet Lamayastua leads his teammates back to school, their strides still strong after 5 fast miles. Rick Baker thinks Lamayastua has a chance to be the next great Hopi runner. Like many Hopi, he began running at a very young age. He says his mother would drag him up the steep trails climbing First Mesa, one of 3 mesas where the Hopi settled nearly 1,000 years ago.
I was in second grade when my parents first started making me run, and I guess I just liked it, so just kept running after that.
Indeed, running is a part of everyday life for the Hopi, a small tribe of fewer than 10,000 people. Foot races are an important part of their intricate ceremonial cycle. Traditional runs like the basket dance and snake dance races start below the mesas, but climb hundreds of feet to finish in the village plazas. Children begin running these grueling races shortly after kindergarten. Iva Sania is one of only 2 seniors on the girls' team. She's been running since the 3rd grade. She's proud to keep alive the Hopi running tradition and her high school streak.
It's like not common, like a school can do this so many years in a row. Compared to other sports, it's real challenging. No timeouts, nothing like that. So it makes me real proud.
Just down the lone highway that traverses the reservation, Bucky Preston lives in a modest home among other members of the Sand Clan. Preston is an ultra-distance runner, but he doesn't run for money or trophies. He logs hundreds of miles to raise awareness for environmental issues. Preston says Hopi people have no choice but to run.
As Hopi people, you know, it's in our blood. We have that. I believe that. And up to this point, you know, our children are still very good runners. It's within them. It's within them because they are Hopi. And it's always going to be there as long as they're running and as long as they're going to keep their roots deep here. We're always going to have a good cross-country team.
Preston is joined by Lee Grover on many of his runs. But the 58-year-old Grover also runs competitively. He's won a number of marathons. A few years ago, the pair ran 75 miles across the reservation on Thanksgiving Day, a personal offer of thanks to their creator. Grover says he learned the spiritual importance of running from his elders.
My philosophy of learning and teachings from my grandfathers and uncles was that you get up early, you go out and run and meet the sun. You just turn back when the sun is rising and pray there that we do have a good, bright, and healthy future for our people. That's our spiritual running.
That strong tradition of spiritual running among the Hopi has helped produce a number of champions off the reservation. Louis Tawanama won an Olympic silver medal in the 10,000 meters in 1912. Juwan Navayakva is the latest in the long lineage of dominant Hopi runners. The 24-year-old led the Hopi Junior High team to a state championship this fall in his first year coaching. Navayakva was a six-time state champion in high school and an All-American at Northern Arizona University, but you wouldn't know it from talking to him.
On the Hopi side, it's more of being humble. We have the basket dance races here, which don't matter if you come in first or last. It's how you finish for the strength of your life and for all living things on Earth and whatnot.
Despite the long history of talented Hopi runners, few have succeeded in college. Many have difficulty leaving behind the close-knit reservation community. If there's one message Navayakva wants to get across, it's that running can take you places.
I wanted to come back to teach these kids that it's possible to go off and do something great, sacrifice 5-7 years out of your own life, do something great for yourself, and come back and work with your own people. And I hate to say that I'm not a role model, but there's times where I come to realize that I am, and I know a lot of kids look up to me, and that's something that I guess I can be proud and honored about.
Ultra-distance runner Bucky Preston also is a role model. He says it's his responsibility to teach the importance of running to young Hopis. But above all, he says he's proud of the high school teams. He personally thanked them after they qualified for the state meet.
Because this is what we are taught, you know. Thank you for running for my life and making me strong. That's what I think about when I'm running. I think about the younger people, how comfortable they are still in their running, how strong they are, and I ask for their strength when I am very tired at my age, you know, and I ask for their strength, and, you know, I'm really proud of them. I'm really proud.
For Only a Game, I'm Daniel Crocker on the Hopi Reservation in Northeast Arizona.
Get it up.
Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Matt Odette, Mitch Teich, and from Bud Eaton at KPBS in San Diego. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or learn more about Racing the Sunset, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Ed Norton, responding to Ralph Cramden's assertion that talking to a golf ball is just plain silly.
They say tally-ho when they're fox hunting. What's crazier, saying tally-ho to a fox or saying hello to a golf ball?
So long, Art Carney. May all your drives be straight and true, and may none of them end up in the sewer. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.